Hello, and welcome to another weekly edition of Popcorn Optional, a movie podcast where we talk all things movies. And this week, we are going to be doing a review of The Post, the new Steven Spielberg film starring Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, and a cast of a bunch of other wonderful people. I'm Cameron Salina, and tonight I'm joined by my co-hosts Jake Brown and Trevor Allison.
What's up?
Hello.
So guys, a big thing happened this week. The Super Bowl.
The big game.
Big game.
Legally, we have to call it the big game.
I was going to say, can we say those words?
I don't know.
Yes, we... hold on. Wait, 1 second. Let me check with our lawyers really quick. Nope. Yep. We're good. Okay. We have access to the Super Bowl trademark. And, you know, luckily... can we call it the big game? It was supposedly like the lowest ratings the Super Bowl's had in like 10 years.
It wasn't a great
game. But it
was
like the most fun... It was an interesting game the whole time, though. It was fun to watch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nah. That's fine. Okay. It was an interesting game. But the big thing was that there was lots of Super Bowl trailers.
Yeah.
And some from films we had already seen stuff from, some from films we were anticipating, some from films that we didn't even know were happening, but apparently are. And so we're going to try and get through all of these Super Bowl trailers in the next couple minutes. And the first one that I think we obviously have to talk about is Solo, A Star Wars Story. I will be honest. I was underwhelmed by the trailer that played in front of the Super Bowl.
Really?
I was a little underwhelmed, but I was entirely overwhelmed by the shot of Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian wearing
yes.
a fur coat.
100%.
That should have been the whole shot. The whole teaser should have just been that.
Yes.
And then
Han Solo is also in 30 seconds of flashing lights and Donald Glover standing there. That's a trailer.
Did you guys watch the rest of the trailer or like the actual trailer that was online?
Yes, yeah. And I was underwhelmed by the Super Bowl trailer, but that one I was in love with.
I liked both. You know, this movie's had so much drama. The fact that it even is coming out is like, oh man, here it comes. Who knows what's going to happen? This is a great trailer. I mean, Disney cuts a heck of a trailer, but this gives me like hope. I mean, the cinematography... I thought Rogue One was beautifully shot, but Bradford Young, holy crap. This is
right.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
It looks like it's going to be like a swashbuckling pirate movie kind of.
Yeah.
Yes.
It kind of does.
Which I'm cool with.
Yeah, I'm totally... The interesting thing is that this trailer doesn't really give you any insight as towards what the tone of the movie is. Like, we still don't know, like, okay, is this a comedy? Like, what is this film really... Like, we know it's about a young Han Solo, but like... Tone and backstory, like we have no idea what's about to hit us, and that's kind of exciting. Like we knew going into Rogue One it was a war heist film, and that was cool, but we have no idea what this is about to be. And that's
I also forgot like how amazing this cast was. Like I forgot Woody Harrelson was in it, I forgot Emilia Clarke was in it. Like this is a stacked cast.
Yeah. It's a great cast. Thandi Newton's in it. Donald Glover, which we already talked about. And I like. Have you guys seen Hail Caesar, the Coen Brothers film?
No, I never got around to it. But I do love the Coen Brothers.
It's the only film that I've seen Alden Ehrenreich in, and that film was okay, but he was fantastic in it, and I think he looks kind of perfect in this role.
Yeah,
he kind of has that like Han Solo swagger.
It felt right.
The end of the trailer that's online where he's, I don't know if he's doing the Kessel Run or what, but when he's in that like vortex he's flipping around, that shot, I was like, okay. Okay.
And he delivers the line like Han Solo.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's there.
Yes. And like the facial expressions and everything. I think it's enough of an homage to Han Solo while still being like unique in its own right. Do you guys have any other thoughts on Solo?
I'm excited.
About
it. Yeah.
Excited. Mission Impossible Fallout is the next trailer. We haven't talked Mission Impossible whatsoever on this podcast at all. Where are you guys on this series? Do you guys like this series?
So in my mind, everything starting Mission Impossible 3 and forward is it's the gold standard in the spy action genre, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's on a different level than most everything else. It has beautiful action. It has somewhat interesting stories. They're not plausible, but none of these movies are. That's not what this series is about. I thought that Ghost Protocol is one of the great action movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Rogue Nation was pretty good, not great. I'm intrigued by this. I think Alec Baldwin was an interesting addition to the series, and I like his character. So I think this look, it's going to be fun, like all of them. It's Tom Cruise running. What else do you want?
Right.
These movies are like weirdly some of the most entertaining and fun movies you'll ever watch, but also some of the most like forgettable. Like, I don't think about Mission Impossible unless I'm watching Mission Impossible, you know?
Right.
Maybe that's just me. But yeah, it looks like more Mission Impossible, which is always great.
Yeah. Trevor, I'm kind of flipped on you. I was a big fan of Rogue One, and I don't have the fondest memory of Ghost Protocol, and maybe it's because he actually says the line "Mission Possible" as he's trying to defuse a bomb, and that just kind of threw me over the edge. But yeah, this trailer is interesting. I'm always in for whatever kind of crazy stunts Tom Cruise wants to pull, and this one looks to be in that same vein as the past couple ones, but... Mission Impossible Fallout looks good.
Tom Cruise has like the highest floor consistently of any actor.
Do you think so? Because there was a while there where he was dogging it.
I think not necessarily his performances, but the movies that he's in. He's not in bad movies. He's in mediocre movies sometimes, but he's not in bad movies.
That's fair.
Even Days of Thunder is entertaining, you know? like there's always something there.
That's true. I'll give you that. That is Mission Impossible Fallout, and that will be coming out July 27th in the United States. We also got a 30-second teaser for Avengers Infinity War, which literally had my jaw on the floor at multiple points.
I can confirm. Yeah.
It can confirm.
Yeah.
There's so many individual shots in this trailer that are just like fanboy dreams. And I know that Marvel's probably playing up to that, but it was perfect. It was the exact like little tease that I needed. Did you guys watch this one?
Yeah. I watched it again online, and y'all, there are some like moments in this that are pretty epic that if you watch it back, it like gives away a lot of not like gives away stuff, but just makes you like, oh my gosh, this is gonna be crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did my thing where I saw what was happening, knew what was coming, and left the room.
Trevor,
are you out on all of the future Avengers Infinity War trailers?
Yeah, the first trailer was the best trailer I've ever seen. Don't at me. and don't challenge me on that, because it's definitely not, but it was amazing. So yeah, I don't need anything else. I don't want to know a dang thing about this movie. Even though I secretly suspect that everything they've shown us is from the first two acts of the film.
I would say first two acts of the film, probably. That's a fair assessment. There's a shot that like really blew my mind, and it was that shot of Tom Holland like in space taking off his mask, and I don't know why, but that was the coolest moment of the trailer for me. Like that shot alone was just, oi, I'm ready. My body is ready. All right. Well, anyways, Avengers Infinity War comes out May 4th, and we will be for sure doing a review on that. The next up is going to be a film that I was shocked that a trailer got dropped. And then also got dropped on Netflix that same night, Cloverfield Paradox.
Yeah, it's that was crazy.
It's crazy, and it is not getting good reviews.
The Beyonce distribution method,
which I'm a big fan of. Like, just drop a movie, let people see it. But it seems like this was more of a, this film isn't good, let's let Netflix buy it, and then just release it online.
Yeah, especially after everyone kind of liked 10 Cloverfield Lane and it was kind of this surprise money-making hit.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of shocking. And I'm hoping to check that out this week. So on next week's episode, I will maybe be able to give a little mini review. But the trailer was great. And what's interesting is it came out today. Do you guys take a guess? Did you guys see the number as to what Netflix paid for this? Take a guess.
15 million.
15 million, Jake?
10.
$50 million.
Whoa, way to go, producers.
Yes. So good job to Bad Robot, because you guys just sold a film to Netflix for $50 million and still control the intellectual property and the future sequels and everything. So way to go, Bad Robot.
Even when JJ makes a bad movie, he doesn't make a bad deal.
That is true.
That is
JJ
true.
Is a businessman. That he is. Anyways, moving on to another film that I didn't really know was happening, but if you're into films that are diehard ripoffs starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson, there's a film coming out called Skyscraper that is a diehard ripoff starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
And like a, maybe also a The Raid ripoff and also a utopian, dystopian kind of deal too.
Yeah.
This just looks bad.
When the like button of your trailer is Dwayne The Rock Johnson hanging from his prosthetic leg, and the cliffhanger is like, does his prosthetic leg fall off and he fall? That's no.
So
no.
The prosthetic leg here seems really gratuitous with the plot of the rest of this film.
Yeah,
it just seems silly almost.
Let me ask you guys this. How far do you guys think Dwayne The Rock Johnson can jump?
With one leg?
As far as he needs to.
With one leg, yes.
It's as far as he needs to. That's the only answer to that question.
So there is a lot of people destroying the poster and trailer for this because it makes it look like Dwayne The Rock Johnson can straight up jump like 50 feet from skyscraper to building. And I don't know about you guys, but I think the world record's in the 30s. So, yeah. Way to go, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. You can do anything. We also have Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, which I'm starting to get to the realization that this is the series that there's a good chance that there may never be a film as good as the original in the series, as good as the original. But by golly, I will be in the seat opening weekend for every single movie. Because it's dinosaurs and Chris Pratt.
This is a bad trailer.
Why is it a bad trailer?
It's not good. Like nothing about this movie has like the spirit of the original Jurassic Park. It has like typical, it feels like The Rock is going to be in this movie. Like,
but wouldn't that be amazing?
Jumping. And I would also recommend everyone read the article that we tweeted out about the importance of aspect ratios, because the aspect ratio of this film is so wide that you totally lose the sense of scale of the dinosaurs that you had in the original film, which is why Spielberg shot it in 2:1. So there's a little film technical theory for you there, but it's a legitimate thing, and I think it has kind of ruined Jurassic Park. I don't like it.
This trailer makes this film look like almost a shot-for-shot remake of The Lost World, just with more people.
Yeah.
So I don't understand what's going on there, but if Jeff Goldblum is in here and telling everyone they're idiots about dinosaurs, I'll watch it. It's worth it.
I'm in. Did you know that guys know that Super Bowl trailer with Jeff Goldblum was actually directed by Colin Trevorrow? Seems to have a little bit of free time on his hands now that Star Wars 9 isn't his.
Ouch.
Burn. No, I'm sorry. That's rude of me, but it was a good commercial. And lastly, the other trailer that played that's involving movies is A Quiet Place with John Krasinski. And while John Krasinski hasn't had the best record post office, I just can't help but be hopeful about this film. It just looks so good. So good.
This looks absolutely bone-chillingly terrifying.
Yeah. Yes.
And I don't want to see it, but I do want to see it basically to see how they manipulate sound in this film, which I think might be the most interesting part of it.
Yeah.
What they do technically with the sound.
I'll be frustrated if like in the third act or like in like after the first act, it's like, oh wait, it's not actually sound that they are doing. And they kind of throw that principle out the window. And then it's just like, but we need to hear John Krasinski and Emily Blunt have a conversation. And it's like, no, we don't know. Let's just do a silent film. That's a horror film.
It looks so
right.
Good.
I want only whispering in this film.
I don't even want whispering. I don't want to hear John Krasinski's beautiful voice.
It looks good.
But if I do, I'm not going to be upset because, you know, John Krasinski is... I was going to say a mensch, but maybe that's a conversation for another day.
Jim Halpert is a mensch. John Krasinski
He's just lovable.
Not. Yes.
He's so lovable.
That
Although,
is Quiet
I will
Place
say,
coming out April 6th.
I'm pretty excited for the new Jack Ryan series on Amazon. I'm interested to see what they're going to do with it. And it looks like they spent a lot of money on it. So I think it might be pretty good.
It's frustrating that it's been constantly like hyped. It's constantly been like, oh, it's coming soon. It's coming soon. Coming early 2018. And then they drop a date and it's like April like 20th or something that it comes out.
Oh, I thought it was like August.
No. Yeah. August. Sorry. Yeah. No, even worse.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was the teaser was great, though. I think it may be really in the spirit of the whole Jack Ryan thing, which has been like the weirdest, most bizarre mess of a franchise
right.
in the history of film, I think. John Krasinski, I don't know if he's the right guy for it, but he's lovable, like I said.
Right. I think more than anything, what these Super Bowl trailers reveal to me is that 2018 may be a year with very few huge box office films. Because normally there's like tons of big budget summer movies and they're like looking forward after like watching all of these. There's not that one, like there's not like multiple films that are these huge summer tentpole films. It seems like it might be a quieter year at the box office, which is interesting, but we'll have to see what ends up happening the rest of the year. Were there any trailers that you guys just loved or commercials?
Tide, man. Tide killed it. Because
David Harbour is so good.
You got to the point where you thought like any commercial could be a Tide commercial.
Right.
And they just killed it. It was perfect.
The best one for me was the Peter Dinklage Doritos one.
That one was great.
Because Peter Dinklage is amazing. So let me ask you guys this. Which trailer... quote unquote, won the Super Bowl? Like, which was the trailer that you guys walked away going, I'm more pumped for that than anything else I saw?
For me, it's Solo. I mean, there's been just so much drama behind the scenes and there were so many talented people attached to it, but it's just like, we have no idea what it's going to be like. And then to see that trailer, it just makes me really excited for it.
Right.
I don't know. It's not like I didn't trust Kathleen Kennedy or Disney and Lucasfilm and everything that was going on, but I'm now at the point where I'm like, this is one of my most anticipated films of the year.
Trevor, what about you?
Yeah, it was also Solo for me, while being a little bit underwhelmed by the actual spot itself, but just the kind of reassurance of knowing that this is actually happening and knowing what it is and being excited for something like this, which we haven't seen in this universe at all, that no one's done before. And like I say all the time, in Kathleen we trust. So I think that they worked out whatever needed to be worked out, and I think it's going to be good. Super excited for it.
I think I still remain skeptical on this film. Like, we've never seen a bad Star Wars trailer. Even the prequels had good trailers. And while I'm excited for Solo, it's like, not to the level of this director, but it's like when Zack Snyder puts out a trailer and you're like, look, the dude can cut a trailer. Like, his trailers are always great, but is the movie
that
any
Sucker
good?
Punch trailer?
Yes. That Guardians of Gahool trailer. I'm excited for this movie, but I think the one that ultimately like left me the most excited is Infinity War. And it's just because it's the culmination of 20 plus movies, 10 years of work. I mean, it's so many different things coming together, and we finally get to see, I think, what like really everybody's been waiting for, which is just this like all out, no holds comic book war. And that's going to be really exciting. So I'm pumped. I'm pumped for that. But those are the Super Bowl trailers. If you are interested in watching any of them, just go YouTube them. Go find them out. And we'll be doing reviews more than likely on all of those that we talked about, with the exception of maybe Cloverfield Paradox, because it just got released. There's not much hype around it, unfortunately. But there's probably going to be another Cloverfield movie that comes out later this year that takes place during World War II. Interestingly enough, called Overwatch.
Crazy.
Cloverfield Overwatch? Overlook? Something like that. Let's go ahead, and we're going to do an edition of Underrated, where we talk about movies that are criminally underrated and movies that people should be checking out, even though nobody is talking about. So let's go ahead and get into a movie that we each think is criminally underrated. Jake, what is your underrated pick for this week?
Yeah, so mine is a little flick by director Alfonso Cuarón from 2006. And it stars Julianne Moore and Clive Owen, and showed us really what Chivo can do with a camera. And that is Children of Men. I think one of the best sci-fi movies, maybe one of the best movies ever, that for some reason people just kind of forget. Right. And I think it's really underrated.
Yeah, this is one of the, I would say one of the 10 best movies of the 21st century, probably. Maybe one of the 10 best sci-fi movies of all time.
Yeah.
What Cuarón and Chivo did in this film is insane. The scene where they're driving in the Land Rover, and the way the camera moves in there,
right,
and the way they did that, there's a little featurette on that that you should go check out if you've seen Children of Men. It's pretty insane. The long shots in this movie are amazing and beautiful. There's probably four or five shots, I want to say, that are like 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes long, that are just incredibly impressive. On top of that, it's a great story, an interesting story, very well acted film. This is a film, when I talk about it, most people haven't seen it whenever I bring it up, and I don't know why that is,
yeah,
because it's truly great.
It's like, for film lovers, everyone knows about Children of Men and like respects it, but it just like hasn't hit the general public in a way that it should.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's also incredibly creative in how it shapes this future world. It takes place in, I think, like the 2027, but the movie came out in 2006, but they knew that the Olympics were going to be in London in 2012. So Clive Owen wears a London 2012 Olympic shirt for most of the film. And that's just like a small little detail that it's so brilliant how they just crafted this, and how they do, like, Michael Caine listens to modern music, like electronic music from early 2000s, and Clive Owen's like, man, that music's so retro, even though like at the time when it came out, it was current.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's little things like that that are just such creative, brilliant touches for sci-fi that we haven't really seen before. And yeah, way underrated. I wish this film had more notoriety around outside of the film circle. So yeah, really good pick, Jake. Trevor, what is your underrated film for this week?
Okay, mine is, you guys are going to love this, it is not near of the quality of Children of Men. It's like not even... It's like not even in the same universe of quality whatsoever. But this is a fun little film franchise that sort of wrapped up its last one a couple years ago, that are just like imminently watchable Friday night popcorn movies. And that is the series Underworld, starring Kate Beckinsale,
Your
favorite dark vampire.
I don't think These that's underrated. I think it's properly under.
They're not good, but they're a lot of fun. It builds, there's a complete universe that's built here. There's a lot of history and depth to it. It even has a prequel. These are fun movies.
Yeah.
I think they're overrated, because anytime I like for some reason have access to cable. They're on like FX or something. And I'm just like, why? Right. Why? So I unfortunately am going to say no. These movies are appropriately rated.
I think they're more guilty pleasure.
Yeah. Guilty pleasure is
okay,
a better term.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. I think that their entertainment value is higher than their quality and that they don't get their due for that.
Okay.
That's fair. I'll give you that. I mean, these movies do have Michael Sheen, who is an incredible talent, but it also has...
And Bill Nighy, who's also great.
Well, I was about to say it also has Bill Nighy doing a weird, like, Eastern European thing that's...
Yeah, yeah. Also, legitimately, we say this a lot, but I think this is the role that Kate Beckinsale was born to play. She really owns this thing.
Trevor, have you kept up with the series throughout the years?
I have not seen the most recent one. I've seen the first four.
Okay.
I did not see Blood Wars a couple years ago. Something I can appreciate about the series is they kind of know what's up. Each film has been shorter than the one before it in runtime.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, like,
okay, so the newest one, I was about to like make a joke about like you hadn't seen it and neither had anybody else, blah blah blah. It was on a budget of $35 million and made $81 million.
Oh dude, these things, like, they've got a fan base. Dude.
Oh my gosh. Okay, the fourth one was a budget of $70 million and made $160 million.
These things
are crazy.
Yeah, these things print money.
Yeah. Yeah.
How is this happening?
Yeah. I told
you. They've made over $500 million.
Oh my gosh. This is blowing my mind. These films should be nowhere near that kind of money.
Kate Beckinsale, this like owns this franchise. That's what brings the people back.
Kate Beckinsale in like skin tight leather matrix suits. that's what you're
looking
for. Bright
blue with like computer enhanced blue eyes. Yes.
This is like the dream of the early 2000s come to life. Like shiny black skin tight leather everywhere. Punk rock music playing in the background of slow motion, dual wielding Uzi vampire werewolf fight. But no, they're still not underrated.
You guys, is Kate Beckinsale in anything else? Or does she just, like, is she solely do these? Oh, she was in that Total Recall movie.
She only plays vampires.
Yeah, I exclusively do vampire roles.
A couple years ago, that would have kept you busy.
Yes, when Twilight was a big deal, you would have been killing it. Alrighty, well...
Yeah, I think that the Total Recall remake is the only thing I've ever seen her in besides Underworld.
My underrated movie for this week is a film from way back in the day in 2003 when we were but mere teenagers. It's a film starring Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany, and... Unfortunately, it went up against Lord of the Rings, Return of the King at the Oscars. Otherwise, I think it would have won a lot more. But it's a film called Master and Commander, Far Side of the World. And it is amazing. And nobody talks about it. Nobody brings it up. I don't know why.
This movie it's great. Like, it's me. Actually, now that you bring it up, me and a guy that I work with a couple days ago were randomly talking about how this movie just like, should have been a huge series, but wasn't.
Yes.
It also is like, we were also talking about how, is there anything like more pop culturally relevant, but also like less successful in film and television than like the pirate / like sailor era? I don't know. I feel like the only thing that is good is Pirates of the Caribbean, or like that is remembered, it's Pirates of the Caribbean. We're like, this is fantastic.
They're so expensive.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
For sure. But that this movie,
that's why they don't get
underrated.
Made.
This movie's underrated.
Yeah, this movie, even though it mostly takes place on a single boat, is a $150 million budget.
Crazy.
They have to shoot it out at sea.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's 15 years ago, $150 million budget.
Uh-huh. And it only made 212.
This is a really good movie. I don't know that I've seen it since I was like 16 years old. I'm trying to kind of remember. I don't even remember totally the plot, but I remember thinking it was really good. It was the height of the Russell Crowe years.
Yes.
With this and Gladiator. something else that I can't, A Beautiful Mind, where he had that like run of maybe being the best actor alive for a few years.
Yeah. He was the Denzel of the early 2000s,
which is kind of weird to think about now. Yeah. Now he's sort of Liam Neeson-y. But
don't you dare knock Neeson's. You take that back, Trevor.
He's got a great
voice. Take it back
voice.
Right now. I want to hear it on the podcast.
Man, his best role in the last 20 years was as a lion.
How about a dad when his daughter was straight tooken?
Wait, I think... the guy who had a very particular set of skills? Is that who you're talking about? Oh, okay. Yeah, that wasn't good.
So, interesting note, Master and Commander was nominated for 10 awards and won cinematography and sound editing. 10 awards. I wouldn't have thought that many.
And no one thinks about it anymore.
Nobody talks about it.
Shooting on the water is hard.
Yes.
It's like in gymnastics, like the people with the harder routine have a lot more margin for error, you know?
Right. If I remember right, I'm pretty sure that they shot this on a like water tank in Mexico. Like they weren't actually out in the ocean.
Oh.
It was on like a giant tank.
Of course. Like you don't go on the ocean unless you have to go on the ocean.
Right.
There's big waves in the ocean.
Waves? What? No. No, but this is a film that I think even a couple like months ago there was a rumor that they might put out another film. And that's exciting because man, these are like this, there's just like Jake, you said it best. It's like this should have been a massive film series. Like there's so much potential here.
Yeah, it's great.
So
underrated.
Master and Commander, Far Side of the World is officially underrated. But let's go ahead and get to our review of The Post, where Jake and Trevor will be reviewing that film tonight.
All right, we're going to get into our review of The Post. Cameron was not able to see the film this week, so me, Trevor, and Jake are going to talk about this. This is our first podcast without Cameron.
Yeah.
Cameron is usually the guy who kind of leads the conversation and asks the questions. So who knows how this is going to go.
Probably better.
But oh, look out. Hope he doesn't listen to this. So we'll talk about The Post. Jake, what were your kind of general thoughts about it?
Yeah, so... general thoughts. I think this movie is incredibly important and timely with a message that everyone in America needs to hear right now. Unfortunately, I was a little disappointed in the movie, which we'll get into specifics on that later. The movie is entertaining. It's informative. And it's an incredibly important message. I just don't know if this was like the perspective to take with this story, which we'll talk more on later. But yeah, overall, pretty good, a little disappointed.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same way. This was kind of a general letdown for me. I'm kind of a journalism guy. I mean, I know I've talked about being a film major and being in film school. I ended up with a minor in film and switching to journalism, worked for the school paper. Haven't really worked in the field of journalism, but I'm familiar with how it works. I keep up with kind of journalism at large, and I'm kind of just the news junkie in general. So I like seeing this side of things. I like seeing this part of the story. This is by no means a bad movie. I think it's a good movie with a good message. It's not what it could have been. It tells sort of the way that it tells the story is not interesting.
Yeah.
And it's a terribly interesting story. It's one of the most interesting things in the last half of the 20th century, as far as American politics and America's place in the world. So yeah, it's not what it could have been. It's very well acted. The cast is amazing. But it kind of has this feel of like Steven Spielberg called a bunch of his actor friends and they like made a movie over the weekend.
Yeah. Which they basically did. The production schedule on this thing was like, I think from pre-production to delivery, it was like 8 months, like crazy fast.
It felt a little bit like they got the message they wanted to send out got in the way of actually making a really good movie.
Yeah. Like what you said, I mean, this is one of the most interesting and important stories in American history, but I don't understand the choice of like telling it from this perspective. Like, we didn't have any of, like, the active investigation of something like Spotlight or Zodiac. And, I mean, I know this is based on a historical event, but like, maybe tell it from the perspective of the New York Times reporter who actually did the digging, or like the guy who like smuggled the documents. Like, I just didn't feel like a sense of urgency with this movie. It kind of felt like things were just sort of falling into place without them trying too hard. They were being like acted upon by external forces like the New York Times, the government, the board, until at the very end they decide to go to print. That's really the only decision that the cast makes. And, you know, it's a brave and heroic choice that quite possibly saved the First Amendment and the country as we know it. But that moment doesn't land the way it should. It's like we aren't discovering things with the characters. Instead, we're being told, I mean, kind of like you said, we're being told this is important by like important speeches by important actors with the Spielberg camera move on them. And, you know, it's hard with stuff like this where it's kind of a biopic, but it's like it's based on a historical fact. And, you know, it's tough to tell a really compelling story when you know what's going to happen. But it's Spielberg. Like, the screenwriter and the Spielberg need to know that that's what we as the audience are going to experience, and they have to tell the story from a new perspective that makes it interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's my big thought on the movie.
It's got a great message, but it's sort of heavy-handed. It's sort of like, here's how you can connect this to today if you can't figure it out on your own.
Yeah.
especially with the Richard Nixon scenes.
Yeah.
They felt very pointed.
They were, though.
Our current president.
Well, those were the actual tapes, though, that were playing.
Right, right.
Which is crazy.
Right.
To think that we're basically repeating the past right now.
Yeah, Richard Nixon was an interesting fellow. Which we could talk at length about on a not movie podcast. So what do you think? I know we talked about the cast. Do you think Streep is deserving of the Oscar nod?
It's tough to say because, you know, Meryl Streep she's probably one of like the most consistent good actors or actresses in Hollywood, along with Tom Hanks, but like, she's just never bad. She can be in a terrible movie, but still give a great performance. But honestly, I don't know if there was enough here to warrant like her getting nominated for a best actress. Like, she's fine. She's not incredible, but it's Meryl Streep, so I guess just give it to her.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I definitely don't think she's gonna win. I think she was good. Very, very convincing, compelling. I almost, this movie would have been served in a lot of ways to show us about 20 minutes more of her, in different places. And really, I think the way you fix this movie is you make it more about Cary Grant.
Yeah.
Than you do about the papers or the newspaper itself. As far as supporting cast, I thought that Bob Odenkirk did maybe the best. I mean, he's so great as Saul on Breaking Bad, the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that this was at least equal to that performance. I thought that he really was kind of the guy that stole the show in some ways.
Yeah, I'm also a huge David Cross fan, and so that was great to see him in this, like, holding his own with those other amazing actors that were on screen. I felt bad for Sarah Paulson. Like, she's one of the best actresses working in Hollywood right now, and she was just like stuck in this nothing role.
Yeah,
but
I felt the same way. At first I was like, wait, is that Sarah Paulson?
Yeah.
Maybe she'll do something else. No. Nope, not really.
But if Spielberg calls, I mean, you say yes. So
yeah, that's what I was saying. The talent in this cast from top to bottom, that's kind of what I was thinking about. Like, Spielberg called up a bunch of his friends. That's kind of what I feel like here, is that he called these people and were like, hey, we're making a movie. Hey, Bradley Whitford, come over here and do this.
Yeah.
Hey, David Cross, here's this weird hairpiece that you're going to act, that you're going to do a great job of acting while you're underneath it.
Or like Alison Brie, just hang out in your pajamas for a day. Okay. That's a wrap on Alison Brie. See ya. Like,
yeah, Alison Brie is not the kind of person you get for that role.
No.
That's like a no-name backseat kind of role.
Yeah. But, I mean, I agree with the acting, the performance, the cast are all phenomenal. Like, Tom Hanks is Tom Hanks as usual. I mean, that's what you can say about everybody that's in this film, is they just, they are what they are. Spielberg is super Spielberg-y. The camera movement through the newsroom in this, it, like, some of the best cinematography of the year in terms of camera movement that supports the story. I loved the aspect ratio to show, like, the height of things. It would have been really easy to shoot something like this in anamorphic, but they went with more of like a 2-to-1 aspect ratio. I don't know. This movie's weird because it's like nothing is bad, but it doesn't land the plane, in my opinion.
It doesn't make the stakes feel real.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no emotion here. Why is there no emotion in this film? There should be like crazy amounts of emotion going on here. Did we need to like show more like Vietnam protest or like more scenes of Vietnam? I don't really know. Without turning this into like a Ken Burns kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't really know. I mean, what do you think it needed? What could have been something that could have been tweaked?
That's a good question. And I've been thinking about it since I saw it yesterday, trying to figure that out. I think there's not enough. It's weird. There's too much exposition, but there's not enough of the right exposition, I don't think. I think like you said, it should be either Catherine Graham's story or Ben Bradley's story or the writer's story. Like, but instead it's just kind of this collective, like the post, you know, and we're trying to follow all of these threads with just a little bit of information and a little bit of context of each of these characters. Like the first 35 minutes happened so fast with so many like historical name drops that I feel like unless you've read up on this controversy and Watergate and stuff, you aren't going to know what's going on for half the movie. And I think a lot of that just has to do with a really broad narrative with a lot of characters and a lot of moving pieces. This probably should have been a mini series.
Yeah. I think you're right. Cause I mean, I was like, you said the first 30 minutes or so, I'm trying to like put my timeline together in my head. I'm doing like Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon. Where does Bob McNamara fit in this? Where does Henry Kissinger fit in this? When did Vietnam things happen? When was Gulf of Tonkin? When is all of this? How are these papers coming out? Like all of those things were coming. It was almost like I knew so much of this. Like I knew enough of it beforehand that I got bogged down with trying to get it all straight while watching the movie.
Mm-hmm. And there's not enough like setup for Vietnam to feel present in the film or for Catherine Graham's like life that she's gone through to feel the weight of it or for Ben Bradley's like passion of news for that to feel weighty. It's just kind of like all over the place. And I don't know. I mean, it does a good job at certain aspects, but I think that's what you said is there's no urgency. There's no weight. By the end of the movie, also, I was like super excited for them to get into Watergate, and then the film just like ends. And I was like, ah, dang it. And the theater I was in was pretty empty, and the people that were in there were like, ah, when it ended, and like got up and just walked out.
What? I don't understand the point of showing the Watergate break-in. Is it so that this can act as a prequel to All the President's Men? I just don't.
Maybe. It's, I don't know.
That was they both have Ben Bradley in them in prominent roles. Yeah. So, but I mean, that was like a bizarre decision to me.
It felt like they were saying like, and this is what happened because the Post stood their ground. The end. Yeah. Like,
or like Richard Nixon got what he deserved.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, it's weird.
It is weird. It was a weird way to end it. I was like, oh, sweet. We're going to get into Watergate now. Like things are about to pick up. Yeah, this movie is important and it has a great message. It's pretty heavy handed. I don't know if it lands the plane, but I mean, it was fine.
Yeah. I hope that people who don't know a lot about like the background of things like this and how journalism works and how it works in conjunction with the First Amendment, I hope that just the name of Spielberg and Hanks and Streep were able to bring some people to the movie that could learn a little bit more about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So you're the historical buff on this podcast. I mean, how do you think the film did with the history aspect and like the Pentagon Papers? I think people now kind of like forget the importance and the impact of the Pentagon Papers. Like, how do you think the film handled all of that? And also like the Washington Post's actual involvement in all of this.
Yeah, it's sort of a weird thing. I think I think the one thing that it does do a pretty good job of landing is why the papers were important. This idea that as early as 1965, the United States government realized that there was no winnable strategy in Vietnam and continued the war for another 10 years, basically, even after these papers came to light. As far as the Post involvement, it's a weird thing to tell from the perspective of the Post. It's almost like, and it ended up, I did a little research into this. The screenplay was based on like a biography of Kay Graham. So that's kind of where the story comes from, but it's bizarre to tell a story about Kay Graham that circles around the Pentagon Papers when the New York Times had been publishing the Pentagon Papers for at least a couple months. They had them way before the Post did. They had vetted them completely. They had done all of the legwork. I mean, some of the legwork the Post had to redo, obviously, when they didn't have the same things or know the same things and everything. But it's weird that the... In some ways, especially if you're going to consider that the newspaper is a character in this story, which it kind of is, in the real life story, the Washington Post is not the main character. The New York Times is. And guys like Neil Sheehan and the editor, Abe Rosenberg, maybe, I can't remember.
Rosenthal, I think.
Rosenthal, yeah. So, I mean, it's almost like this was like a companion piece to something that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I keep up with history and, I mean, a little bit more than the average person, I would say, nowhere on your level, but even I could tell, like, this doesn't feel right. Because even in the movie, they show, like, the New York Times did all the work. The Post is just kind of this, like, B player. And granted, the Post is a huge player in Watergate, but this isn't the film about Watergate. So like, why are we doing this? I think that's kind of, I was like, I want to see what's going on at the New York Times. I want to see like what went into doing all this research and getting these papers in the first place. Like, that's what I want to see.
Yeah. This, what needs to happen is we need an Aaron Sorkin script about what happened at the New York Times during this time period.
Yeah.
That's a movie that I would watch.
By David Fincher.
That's exactly.
How do you feel about, this is kind of off topic, like, so you watch something like this and then you think of like journalism today and that the fact that the Washington Post is owned by like Jeff Bezos now, I don't know, what goes through your head when you think about that after watching something like this, or even something like Spotlight or Zodiac, like the golden age of journalism?
Well, yeah, newspapers have always been a business. There's a tenuous line there between being a servant of the public while also trying to make money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have the awful doings of the yellow journalism of, Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst, who in the 1890s may have been varying degrees of responsible for the Spanish-American War, to today where we have so much of news media is just a joke and a mockery. You have the consolidation of media by Gannett, who was mentioned in this movie several times as a big player. I think that as far as I think there are enough smart people out there that there's always a place for serious institutions with top level credibility, like the Washington Post and the New York Times. I think that Jeff Bezos has done a pretty good job of balancing those needs as far as I can tell. Because, I mean, it's not good for the Washington Post if people see the Washington Post as serving Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Jeff Bezos is smart enough to understand that. But it is interesting to kind of see a little bit of a microcosm of the paper going from the family business run by someone who's a true newsman into something different where it's just another version of mass media that actually, I mean, frankly, most of its readers don't even read the ink in the paper anymore. Even though I will say there's nothing like reading a newspaper. I'm kind of sentimental about it. Mm-hmm. For a lot of reasons, but the way that it's organized, the way that it's structured, is really a great medium that I hope doesn't go by the wayside completely.
Yeah, we're looking at buying our first house right now, and I like after watching this, I was like, I kind of want to get a newspaper subscription.
Yeah, I mean, there's just something about everything being concise, consolidated. Everything is there. You don't have to click four or five times to find something in the realm of what you want. You say, oh, the local section, let me leaf through and see what's interesting. In some ways, it makes it a little bit easier to find what you're looking for. It's like this weird backwards thing where now it's like, this is the curated form of news, even though it always has been.
Yeah, that's true.
So to kind of go off of that, for you, I mean, I don't know what your knowledge is about the backside of newspaper and how journalism works. Did this like teach you anything as far as that process? Did this film kind of lift the curtain a little bit for that?
So I think some of my favorite scenes of the movie were actually like in the printing press. That was so cool to see those machines working and like how they build out the paper. Like,
it was like How It's Made, produced by Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, it was so cool and so well shot. Like, I did not realize the scale of what it took to print and deliver a paper like that. I think that was maybe my favorite part or my favorite like revelation about newspaper. I mean, the rest is like, I work in the media business. Granted, it's film, but I mean, it's kind of the same thing as like you have a director, which is Ben Bradley, and then you have a producer, which is Kay Graham. You know, in this film, she's the owner of the paper, so she decides what gets published. She funds everything, and you have Ben Bradley leading the creative team.
So, yeah,
I will say, I wish I was an intern for the Washington Post back then, because I mean, you'd get take a train up to New York and investigate some stuff for us and then come back. Little intern. I was like, are you kidding me? That wouldn't happen.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I think just seeing a newsroom in action like this is always fun and something that we don't really have anymore. Just that frenetic energy of phone calls, typewriters. Everything's so digital now.
And making fun of people for using two fingers to type.
That's true. Playing chopsticks over there.
Yeah, this, there's some interesting stuff here. I think that a lot of the powerful moments in this film are some of the lines from Ben Bradley talking about the importance of journalism and the role that the press plays in a free republic. Mm-hmm. This idea of, he says, like, which I think is maybe the lasting impression I got from the film, was the idea that the way that you protect the right to publish is to publish. That telling the story is what's most important, that it's not the role of anyone else to censor the story that you have, and that you don't have to check with anyone because you have the story and you know it's the story and that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a lot of good stuff there. A lot of, I mean, just the idea that, I mean, it's still, this was the first time in American history that a president had taken a paper, in this case, the New York Times and the Post kind of joined in with them, had taken a paper to the Supreme Court saying, this goes against the right of freedom to the press. And I am, for one, shocked that it was only a 6-3 decision and not a 9-0 decision.
I know.
By the Supreme Court. That's astounding to me.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, that shows the power of a president getting to appoint Supreme Court justices that like approve of his opinion. But I also loved the quote of "news is the first rough draft of history."
That was great.
That made me think of like, wow, yeah, we're just living through a rough draft of history every single day.
Well, it's these people who like do this kind of whataboutism or the revisionist thing. Like a week after somebody like the Washington Post publishes a story, they're like, well, you didn't include this or this. Like, that's not what the news is. The news isn't the whole story. It's as much of the story as we can tell as fast as we can.
Mm-hmm.
If you want the whole story, you're going to have to wait 30 years.
Yeah.
Until everything is declassified, until everyone can be talked to, until people like, I don't know, Doris Kearns Goodwin write books about Abraham Lincoln 100 years later, you know, like that's how you get the whole story.
Yeah.
You don't, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Dallas Morning News, whoever doesn't have the whole story. They have as much of the story as they can tell as fast as they can. And I think that's an interesting quote for a lot of reasons, but I think number one is that it can kind of dispel the misconception of what people expect from the news.
Mm-hmm.
I have one quick thing for you. We kind of talked about how it's all over the place. Mm-hmm. Story structure wise, like what is the climax of this film to you? I felt like this was almost like episodic where there were some rising and falling actions several times.
Yeah, I definitely felt that way there. This is a weird film in terms of like act structure. It doesn't feel like there's super defined, like you said, climax, payoff, resolution, setup, conflict. I mean, I think the obvious answer is Kay deciding to go to print. That's kind of what a lot of the drama leads up to, them running the presses, and then you get to see the machine in action, and not just the press itself, but like the machine of the Washington Post going into action. And that was really cool. But then there was like this like drag on of like, well, now we're going to court, and now we're in the court, and now we get the decision. And now, yeah, it's just like, it was kind of all over the place. Like we've said before, it's kind of all over the place.
I think the most tension in the movie was Carrie Coon's character reading out the news coming to her across the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And something that was commonplace in the 1970s and before, and even a little bit since, but now that would have been like an email or a tweet, mm-hmm. or something that like everyone saw at the same time.
Yeah.
Or someone saw and was able to read the whole thing, but she's getting it line by line from someone and sharing it line by line to other people with other people.
Yeah.
Just an interesting tiny little microcosm into what the world was like then.
A simpler time.
I agree. So yeah, this I guess that's all we have to say. This is sort of a weird movie to talk about, I guess.
It is weird, and like historical stuff like this is often kind of hard to digest or to talk about, especially if you are like informed on the subject. But I think that's one of my favorite things about like I, Tonya, is that I know too much about that story based on the amount of times I've watched The Price of Gold on ESPN. But I still loved I, Tonya. I still thought it did an incredible job of telling that story in a really fresh way from a very honed in perspective that really drew you in as an audience member. And this movie was just kind of lacking that for me. I wasn't really drawn in. I feel like they didn't land the plane. There wasn't the weight or the impact that should have been here. Because this is essentially like, this is like assuring American democracy. That's what was on the line here. And I feel like they never really established that. So everyone involved does a fantastic job. I think it mostly just comes down to a pretty rough script, or a, I wouldn't say rough script because there's definitely some bright moments here, but just a weird take on this story, just a weird perspective, maybe the wrong perspective to tell this story, but overall, it's a technical achievement for sure. So my rating is going to be a B to B minus.
I'm surprised after seeing it that it was nominated for Best Picture and then it's been on a lot of people's top 10 lists. I think 10 years from now, we're going to look back and say, why did everyone love that just okay movie that Steven Spielberg made about Donald Trump, except it was set in the 1970s?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this film is going to age super well for a lot of the issues that we've talked about. I wouldn't be surprised if someone came along and made a Pentagon Papers movie that kind of blew this out of the water and was much more of like a legal journalism thriller kind of thing, in the vein of some of the other ones that we've mentioned. But overall, I'm going to give this a $18 a share out of $24.50 a share. So right there in that kind of C-plus territory, which feels so weird to give to a movie that's this well acted, but it just didn't. This movie didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
It just wasn't. It was kind of hollow.
Yeah, me too, man. So you're not alone. We'll be alone together.
There we go. And hopefully it doesn't win any awards because there's other things that are much more deserving.
I agree.
All right. That's our review of The Post.
Cameron, come. Hold on. I'll go get Cameron. Cameron, we're done. Okay, here he comes.
That is Jake and Trevor's review of The Post. Let's go ahead and get to our content of the week. Trevor, what is your content of the week?
My content of the week is, if you liked The Post, or if you want to know more about the role that newspaper has played in revealing the political scandals of the 1970s, you should check out All the President's Men, starring Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman as Washington Post reporters. It also includes Ben Bradley, the character played by Tom Hanks, in The Post. And it shows the role the Washington Post played in revealing the Watergate scandal and basically bringing down the Nixon administration. It was directed by Alan J. Pakula, written by William Goldman, one of the great screenwriters of all time. This is just a really good movie. This is, in a lot of ways, it's everything that The Post could have been or should have been. And it was made incredibly quickly after the whole Watergate saga going down within a couple years. But this is just an all-time great movie about journalism and politics and how those things intersect.
Good pick. I wasn't able to see The Post, as you know already, but I'm going to recommend a couple Spielberg historical films because they're all great. Lincoln's fantastic. It's Daniel Day-Lewis in one of his best roles. Bridge of Spies kind of goes untalked about. It came out 3 years ago. You also have films like Munich, Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List. The guy is just killing it when it comes to the historical films. And all of those movies should be checked out. They're all amazing films, and they should all be on everybody's watch list if you haven't seen them yet. Oh, sorry, I forgot one. War Horse. Yes, everybody should go see War Horse.
Nope, don't do that.
Nope.
Wrong.
Oh, nope, sorry. Nope, I forgot.
Don't
that
see
one's
War
bad.
Horse.
Right, that one's very, very bad. Jake, what is your content of the week?
Mine are two in the vein of what Trevor said, more journalism focused, and that is one, Spotlight, fantastic film, came out a few years ago, won the Best Picture, and just really gets into the nitty gritty of what it takes to tell an amazing story, and like the newsroominess of journalism, which I think is we're kind of losing in the modern era, but it's really cool. And then secondly, Zodiac, which is another, in my opinion, underrated film, and is just fantastic. So yeah, if you have any interest in like the backgrounds of journalism, or if you want more of The Post but maybe better, check out Spotlight and Zodiac.
Awesome. Well, that is all we have for this week. If you have enjoyed listening to us, go ahead and find us online. You can find us on Twitter at Popcorn Optional, Facebook at Popcorn Optional. We're on our website at popcornoptional.com, and you can come Leave us a message there. Find more of our episode. If you've liked what you've listened to tonight, go on to iTunes. Rate us, share us with a friend. That's the best thing that you can do for us, is just to tell people you know after seeing a movie with them, hey, go check out this podcast. They're probably going to put out an episode on this movie we just saw, or have already put one out, depending on when you see it. So go to iTunes, share us with a friend. That would be the best way for us to grow. We've loved getting to talk to you. My name is Cameron Salina. You can find me online at 321CamiTime. Jake, where can we find you online?
JakeBrown.tv. Trevor?
Twitter and Instagram at Turbo Trevor.
We hope you all have a great week, and to paraphrase the great Michael Scott, we will be back ASAP as possible.